Okay. Following on very neatly from Angela's work here, I want to talk to you about relationship between sort of sustainable lifestyles and meaningful lifestyles, and whether when we're talking about sustainable lifestyles, and when we're talking about sustainable leisure and leisure and sustainable lifestyles, we're always talking about the same thing, or maybe they're slightly different. So that's what I want to examine here today. This is from the sociological strand of the research that Resolve has done, and that's the project team there. I'm going to use the example of serious leisure. Look at this. Just to say, we're not saying that serious leisure is the way forward. We're using that as a vehicle to examine some of this today. So I'm going to come back and talk to you about what serious and intrinsically meaningful leisure means. These findings come from a sample of middle earners that we followed for an entire year across a recessionary year, so August 2009 to 2010. Middle earners, the highest earner in the household, with a middle earner that's between 17 and 27,000 per year. So middle earners are actually quite low incomes, really. And I want to talk to you about how serious practices, leisure practices, become escalated, how they become constrained in their kind of levels of resource use, and what the implications might be for sustainable lifestyles. So Angela has very neatly already talked you through why be concerned about leisure by pointing out that actually leisure accounts for 27% of our lifestyle emissions, of which 17% is due to non-holiday-based leisure. What we also see from work that's been done and resolved by Jackson and Pathathona is that across the period of 1968 to 2000, there's been a 66% increase in fossil fuel resource requirements in leisure due to rising consumer electronics, greater levels of travel for leisure, and a rise in spending on leisure goods. What we also see across the ages, according to Roberts, is a 50% real increase in expenditure on level, but only a corresponding 2% increase in the amount of leisure time we've got. So the intensity of spending on leisure is there, and that allows us, of course, more money to travel further, to buy more specialist goods related to our leisure activities, and to have higher standards and expectations of those goods. So, as I said, I'd talk about serious leisure. What is serious leisure? Serious leisure, according to Robert Stebbins, who is the person who came up with these different categories of leisure between casual leisure and serious leisure, where casuals are sort of immediately accessible. There are things you can just get and do without any specialist equipment, without any specialist knowledge. There are things like going to the cinema, going out for a meal. Serious leisure, instead, is the systematic pursuit of an amateur, hobbyist or volunteer activity that participants find so substantial and interesting that, in the typical case, they launch themselves in a career centred on acquiring and expressing its specialist skills, knowledge and experience. So it's a set of practices whereby actually a lot of it's about competence, is about things that people can feel really good at about themselves, actually develop self-esteem, develop some sense of status outside of the workplace. They have their own social world. Those social worlds might give them different values. They're very good for community. And they're very good for kind of developing all kinds of identities. So they're seen as being kind of pretty good for individuals and for society. But what about serious leisure and sustainability? Well, two potential relationships. I'm not saying those. Two potential relationships there. The first suggested by Rupke and Gustafson in their work on leisure and leisure sustainability, which is some of the few people to have worked on sustainable leisure. And they suggest that serious leisure practices could hold the potential for time-consuming, low-resource-using leisure activities. So basically, things like, say, playing an instrument takes about 10,000 hours to learn to play an instrument really well. That's just got one instrument attached to it. That's very good use of spending time, which has low levels of impact. Now, obviously, some serious leisure practices have much higher levels of impact, but they're saying it's a good way where we can spend time that can be very sustainable. And then the second relationship to sustainable lifestyles links in a lot more with what Juliette Shaw was talking about this morning, and the people who talk about thinking about ways to live which aren't about just going to work, coming home, watching TV, going to work, but economically productive lifestyles, but instead, sorry, do you want to go sit there? But they offer other ways of experience in time, of the ways of living, which are about just being content about doing things that we enjoy, about things that we find pleasurable, that could then give us these other sorts of values outside of merely being focused on being economically productive, of consuming more, and may then offer the opportunity for other ways of being. So what we've done then is we've looked at the serious leisure practices in the sample that we had, and actually there were quite a few in there. Maybe that's because of the sort of people who jump into this kind of year-long study of leisure, that we had a lot of quite active people in there. And we looked at whether their serious leisure practices were indeed sustainable and what kind of constrained them and what didn't. And what we started to see was that even in these sort of these leisure practices which could be local, they could be low resource using, that we were seeing escalations in there which weren't outside of the leisure practice itself but actually came from the fact that people wanted to be more competent at their leisure practice, so they bought more specialist equipment and things that actually increased that competence, and I'll talk through some of those examples there. They wanted to reduce the chore-like qualities of leisure practices. You want to be enjoying yourself, so you want to reduce chore. They wanted to be more comfortable. A lot of our leisure practices are done outside. We have very variable weather, so they wanted to be comfortable whilst doing it. And then this kind of rising sense of expectations of travel, going, you know, I'm a hill walker. It sounds sort of nice and pleasant and low impact, but I want to go and walk the hill in Peru that I read about in my magazine as being the greatest hill to walk. So you see these sort of increasing expectations and standards which are met by innovations which then start to escalate what could be local low impact and leisure practices. Now I'm going to talk through what is perhaps our most extreme leisure practice that we found which demonstrates this, which is bird watching. This is an example of Peter. He started out as a bird watcher. So when I started out, it was me and my mate, we had our bikes, we went out, we went to look at birds. Sounds lovely. What could we want? Nice nature-based, leisure practice, local, low impact. And he said, well, I've got a car. And then I started going further to look at birds. And then I got involved in twitching. And twitching is like a military wing of bird watching, whereby if there's a rare bird, they go to look at it, and you it's competitive. You try to capture every bird in the UK that's there and get seen. And so Peter now says, you know, it used to be a very cheap hobby. Now people are turning up sort of £1,000 to £1,000 pair of binoculars around their neck, a £2,000 telescope over their shoulder, a digital camera, a pager, every waterproof piece of clothing that's ever existed, and everything else. You know, you can have £3,000 to £4,000 worth of stuff on people now. And I said, well, is that sort of people doing it? Changed. He said, it's just the money's there. People want the equipment. They want the, I mean, the photography side, they want the better photographs. So inside the logic of the practice, inside the logic of bird watching and twitching, you start to have people wanting things which give them more competence. The telescope that allows them to see the bird better. The camera which allows them to take a better photograph. The waterproof equipment which allows them to be more comfortable whilst they're doing it. And the pager, which crucially alerts you to the bird being there in the first place. And this is actually escalated the amount of travel that can be done in twitching. He says, about 84, when you first got involved in it, bird watching was diabolical. The information was diabolical. The information came through the grapevine. I mean, the bird could have died 3 weeks ago before I even knew it existed. Pages were put in the beginning of the 90s, to this present day where mayhem is generally done. Now a rare bird has beeped out with text messages, to mobiles, to phone calls, to anything, and people will spend any amount of money to get to see it. Now there was a great photo last week in the newspapers, which was unfortunately copyrighted, of hundreds of people turning up in a town centre in England because this pager system had gone off because of the rare Turkish bird. And so this is now kind of pushing quite far away from A, being a nature-based practice. This is now kind of a competitive sport. You know, there's a lot of equipment involved, there's a lot of travel involved, but it's still within sight the logic of this leisure practice. And becoming more competent in this practice. And Peter says, it is not unusual, and it's not unheard of, for people to charter planes if a rare bird is treated at the other end of the country. So, you can start off with these serious leisure practices that you think, sounds great, sounds lovely, wonderful, that's what we want to promote. But can you constrain them in the logic of a practice where you want to fulfil to the optimum that practice, and particularly when there's a sort of money there available and the innovations available from business to allow more travel? also what does constrain these serious leisure practices, and unfortunately I don't have the time to talk about time, which is one of the serious constraints on there, and I'm not going to touch on social and cultural trends. I'm mostly going to talk about finances here, because of the sample that we looked at. But just to say, at the kind of personal attitudes and values level, what we found was that people really didn't constrain their leisure practices due to their environmental attitudes. And we asked about this last, so we followed it across the years, so we know what people were doing and why they were doing it, and noted that with only one exception did kind of environmental values come up as being something that constrained how they went about their leisure practices. Other values did, I haven't got time to get into, but actually most of the time when we asked people and we said, do you worry about sustainable leisure, they were quite relieved to be asked, and most of them couldn't even name anything about sustainable leisure, so it might be the highest level of impacts from our lifestyles, but it's not really there. It's not out there as a discussion. People aren't really involved in it, apart from sort of flights and a holiday. But what did constrain were the financial constraints, and I said this is quite a limited set of incomes for this group. And across the year, there were rising fuel prices, rapidly rising fuel prices, and also recessionary pressures. And what we certainly saw was those fuel prices having an impact early on. Before we were starting to talk to people about fuel prices, they were talking to us about fuel prices. We were picking it up in interviews, we were picking it up in the diaries that they wrote, that it became a real worry. And people started to get priced out of all kinds of things, but also the recession had an impact on this group. There were a lot of people who were self-employed or shift workers, people who were in quite insecure jobs. So we started to see some serious impacts on their lifestyles. So filtering through, it filters through in a lot of different ways, and it was quite a top level. What happened to leisure was quite predictable. People travelled less, people went out less, people were staycationing, people were watching more television. So there were the sort of things that we expected to happen. When we looked underneath at the serious leisure practices, it became less obvious. It was less predictable. Some people protected them, but some people replaced them. Some people started getting involved at a commercial level in that practice so they could continue doing it. So a couple of examples there. Warren, who was into rallying, as I went to a stage doing rally myself, got too expensive. It was £400 per event. And I said, is that what it takes? And he said, yes, it's crazy. Then he had to maintain the car and insurance and things like that, so it wasn't really viable to do it. So he's replaced that rallying leisure practice with VW clubs, which are a whole new world to me. I'd never heard of these things until I did this, but it's a kind of little car club where people spend a lot of time online talking about pimping up their VW, so it's a much more sustainable practice, really. Peter, our bird watcher, says that he used to go long distances, but most of the time I only stay generally local now because of the cost of petrol. So that's good. Here's some practices that people were involved in. They were very meaningful to them. They were very important, but actually we see higher fuel prices, recessionary forces, controlling that and having good environmental outcomes. Maybe not so good outcomes for what they like to do. Maybe so. But we also see some things that we perhaps don't want to see. This is Jane. She plays in a local brass band. I mean, how good can it get? It's local, it's community, it's one instrument, it's low impact. And she said in the past she has had to sell her horn to get a car. And so that's what she did, but then she bought it back again. And then she lost her job in the recession and went back to a new job and said, it's not earning enough money for me. I can't afford to live on this job. So she's going to go back and retrain in a course which she runs at Manchester College. And she said, so that's in the evening. So I was thinking, if it's only on band nights, then I'll quit band, you know, I'll do that to do it. So there's a leisure practice, a serious leisure practice that we would think, well, that's great, it's a sustainable leisure practice. But through economic forces, she's had to change that. And to give that up. And so we see also then this is a lot of meaningful leisure practices in lifestyles, which men might kind of challenge whether we think that sort of these sort of environmentally sustainable aspects of lives are also matched by sort of the social sustainable lives. Are they matched with how we want people to spend lives away from a sort of purely productive sense of being? Which leads us to ask some questions. Are sustainable leisure and leisure in sustainable lifestyles always the same thing? Yes, we wanted to make leisure more sustainable on the basis of that, but here's this high level of impacts from lifestyles. What we've then seen is that maybe some of these more meaningful leisure practices that we might want for a whole range of other reasons around community, around people's sense of self-actualisation, start to get lost, and maybe there's a difference. Maybe we want to promote one over the other. But more importantly, who's losing these practices? I mean, is it equal, or what we're seeing is this kind of incongruence of being priced out of things, even though they weren't really the problem in the first place, right? Other people who might be more of a problem, might be producing more carbon, probably aren't feeling the same level of impact yet from their from higher fuel prices. So maybe sometimes what's environmentally sustainable isn't socially sustainable. Maybe sometimes we're talking about low carbon lifestyles rather than talking about sustainable lifestyles, particularly when we're talking about some of these pricing options. So where does this take us in policy terms? Well, to some extent, we could say, if we believe in them, and they're obviously subject to critique, these ecological modernisation processes that we see in decoupling, of closed-loop economics, of modal shift, of more efficiency, they could start to take us toward having sustainable leisure without really needing to change anything at the individual level. Those could solve some of those problems, and maybe we can have a sustainable leisure, do quite similar things. But we know we're facing higher energy prices, and certainly if you're looking at carbon taxation, maybe those will start to have an impact, they'll increase some of those ecological modernisation processes, but they might also increase inequalities. So how do we then start to think about what do we do about addressing those inequalities, not just in terms of fuel poverty and people not being able to heat their house, but maybe in terms of other things that they've lost across their lifestyles, which are important to them, which are meaningful to them? Does that matter? Do we think about it, or don't we? So might there be different ways that we can also look at increasing the sustainability of leisure practices? Well, one could maybe need to look at the leisure practice itself and to work with the community of leisure to understand how we might actually increase the sustainability of the practice in a way that doesn't really impact and separate individuals, might increase inequality. And Catherine is going to talk through the example of music as how we can work with communities of leisure to increase sustainability of practices. But maybe more... more radically, and in line with sort of what Juliet Shaw was talking about before, maybe we can also start thinking about, you know, what's meaningful time use? What makes our lives meaningful? What makes us happy in life? What makes us feel content in our lives? And think about time use rather than just finances and productivity in lifestyles. And that might be a very radically different way of understanding sustainable lifestyles and what the role that leisure would play in that. There's a very long paper that we've written on the website about this, which goes into a lot more depth about these issues. If you're interested.
Jeff Beacon, Pollution Tax Association. Have you considered applying Hansen's carbon fee to this analysis, because that would say put the price of carbon up a lot, but in his model it just gives it back to everybody, so the poor would get richer and the rich would get poorer because the poor have a smaller carbon footprint than the rich, and would that not compensate for the difficulties that you envisage over equality?
The short answer is I haven't applied it, but obviously that's sort of what we're trying to hint at by saying, you know, what might this mean at a quality level and what might be a smarter thing. And also, you know, even at a welfare level, if we price people out of things, what might the state provide as well to compensate to traditionally being a provider of you know, leisure activities and leisure facilities in this country. So, yes, I think there are ways of addressing it, but they need to be included in the understanding of those prices in the first place. But I'm not an economist, so there's some in there, but no, I haven't looked at that yet.
Thank you for that talk. What it prompted in me is a question about the extent to which people are trying to seek or even define low-carbon leisure activities. It seems to me that the people you were following had adopted activities for the pleasure that they gave, and you were analysing the extent to which their carbon profile change. But there's, it seems to me, a burgeoning segment of society who actively want to do leisure that is low carbon. Is that something which you capture?
No, we picked up people from an income group. There were a couple of kind of quite environmental people in there. And one of them, I took his quote out, I mean, who actually says he only wears his normal clothes to do leisure in, and it doesn't matter whether it's playing tennis or whatever, because he actually says, no, I'm trying to find ways to reduce my leisure impacts. In terms of looking for a group who are actively trying to seek low-carbon leisure, no, we didn't look at that. But actually, people did talk about... A couple of people talked about their lifestyles, and were kind of quite interested. I had a couple of people in the sample who were quite interested in living low-carbon lifestyles, but only one of them actually then related it to his leisure practices. The other one, it was something that they'd not really thought through, and also just some complex maths in there. But no, we hadn't sort of had to look at those people just because of the sample that we chose, which was based on earnings.
One last question.
I just wondered about gender differences. Did you notice gender differences in the people you were...
Yeah, that was one of the time points as well that wasn't in there in terms of certainly sort of when looked at in leisure, the single thing that makes a difference in terms of how you can spend your time is whether you have a child or not. And mothers in particular find it hard to take time out for themselves for these sort of serious leisure practices. And so there were differences, particularly some of the mothers in the sample, not all of them, had actually adopted serious leisure practices, and again, this is in the longer paper, but I didn't have time to put it here, adopted sort of serious leisure practices which were based on things they were already doing in their lifestyle. So one of them had got very involved in going to car boot sales, which, you know, low income with a couple of kids, single mum. And so she'd then become very fascinated by that and adopted it as a sort of serious leisure practice where she spent hours there going through everything and said that's what she now enjoyed. And another who'd got very involved in cooking, which she was doing anyway, and so it became a cooking thing. And so, those practices, you could say, well, perhaps they're the most sustainable because they're not actually outside of lifestyles. They're kind of an intensification, in fact, of the things that you're already going to do. So maybe, in some ways, they're kind of quite sustainable ways of being.
Is there any difference between men and women who, when you, not including people who have small children, that the sort of escalation, high-tech, expect carbon-intensive escalation on a gender basis?
There was a difference in terms of when we talked to the sort of practices that people did. There were a lot more of kind of craft-based practices amongst the women in there, which were kind of home-based. And so so there was that. But, I guess it also depended. I mean, there was another woman in there who... I mean, she had just changed. She'd said, you know, it used to be that for her, self-actualisation was all about going skiing and going and doing these really exciting adventure things. And she's now changed her mind. And for her, self-actualisation is now growing her own veg. And so at some point she was, but I mean, I guess both in a small sample like this where we follow people closely, I guess it would be difficult to say this is this with any sense of certainty. So yes, there were differences, but I would hate to nail down gender as the defining part.
Let's move on then to counter.